small communities up and down the Nile began to try to manage their little areas of the river. They began to irrigate, they began to drain, and then they began to irrigate, which is to put the water back somewhat more systematically. They began to plant regular crops, mainly cereal grains. Bread, the staff of life. In one way or another, you got to have bread. Now, very slowly, these communities coalesced into things we call nomes. That's a Greek word. Actually comes from the Greek word nomos, which means law. So a law district, a law territory. We actually don't know what the Egyptians called these little communities that began to evolve along the Nile. And then eventually there were leaders in these nomes called nomarchs. Well, once again, that's a later Greek name, a ruler of a nome, you see. Once more, we don't know precisely what the Egyptians called them. But in any case, what we see is that the nomes began to form slightly larger districts. I mean, we might think of them today as counties or something like that in a state, sort of up and down the Nile. And gradually, Upper and Lower Egypt were organized into two much larger areas, and then all of Egypt was unified. Now, a quick word about Egyptian geography. To understand what I'm going to say now, it would be very helpful if you could stand on your head. Because the point is that Upper Egypt is on the bottom and Lower Egypt is on the top. And that's because the Nile flows in a northerly direction from where it rises in Africa to the Mediterranean Sea. So Upper Egypt is on the bottom, but it's nearer the beginning of the Nile, so it's actually the top. You see? Well, in other words, it's perfectly backwards. So as I said, if you were standing on your head just now, that made perfect sense to you. If you weren't, then you just have to trust me. All right. So eventually, Lower and Upper Egypt coalesced, and then slowly but surely, all of Egypt began to be pulled together into a single kingdom. It appears we're working in a realm where our evidence is pretty thin. It appears that the need to control irrigation really drove the creation of larger and larger and larger scale political organizations. Now, this is something that we know from many places in the globe over many moments of human history. Rivers have been used, let us say, for example, to take a quite easy case, to power a mill. Now, if I'm parked at a certain point along a river and I have a mill, and somebody up the river dams the river up because they want to control the water, perhaps they want to have a mill up there, my mill stops. So we have to cooperate, you see, along a river. So if too much irrigation is undertaken, if too much water is diverted at one point along the Nile's course, this would be dangerous for people downstream. So probably the need to cooperate in the management of the Nile is what drove people, you see, to a more unified form of political organization. And this, by the way, is a very good example of how geography can infect how history unfolds itself. I'm not going to tell you, you see, that absent cooperation along the Nile, all of Egyptian history wouldn't have happened, but I can say I think it would have been different. All right. In legend, in myth, and probably, too, in history, a ruler by the name of Menes, that again is a Greek word, unified Upper and Lower Egypt. And tradition says that this was done about 3100 BC. But this unification of Upper and Lower Egypt really ushers in for us the historic period. This is really when we can start talking in some reasonably meaningful sense about Egyptian history. Before this time, our evidence is legendary, our evidence is archaeological, and it has to be pieced together with lots of great gaps. One way to think about this is to imagine a great fishing net, and it's been strung out and suspended, and what we know is the string, and what we don't know is all the holes. That's sort of a way to think about the earliest stages of human history. Yeah, we know a lot, but boy, is there a lot we don't know. Okay. The course of Egyptian history. The Egyptians were fanatical about remembering things and about recording things. And as later people, Greeks and then Romans, admired the Egyptians, they were very interested in preserving these Egyptian preservations of memory. What that means is that historians in antiquity, and so also in modern times, divide Egyptian history into 30-some dynasties, that means families of rulers. Family after family after family, with the names of the rulers in each dynasty recorded one after another, with their regnal years. And we think, actually, that these regnal years are quite accurate. Now, for purposes of discussion, then, historians have spoken of the pre-dynastic period, and then the old, middle, and new kingdoms, with the first and second intermediate periods falling between old and middle and new. That's a modern division that enables us to kind of manage Egyptian history, but the dynasties, the kingdoms, are an old Egyptian way of thinking about their own history. Now, Egyptian history then begins in a very serious way with what we call the Old Kingdom, with the pharaonic dynasties. Ah, what's a pharaoh? We'll come to pharaoh in just a moment. But the names of kings in Egypt are pharaohs, all right? The Old Kingdom, from about 2695 to about 2160 BC, 500 years, plus or minus a bit, was an era of great vitality, of great security, of great prosperity. This was the time, for example, when Egypt was largely isolated from outside influences. Egypt was not overrun as Mesopotamia was. There was some trade. There was certainly some movement of peoples back and forth. But on the whole, Egypt was isolated in ways that Mesopotamia never was.